Hello, I'm John Rossi, a touring drummer with a love of all things animal. When I'm on the road, I visit as many zoos, aquariums. Hey, wait a minute. What's going on? Hey, what's going on there? Hello? Hello?
We interrupt your regularly scheduled program to bring you Rossafari Zoo News. News you can use from the world of zoos and conservation. Every week, we bring you breaking news and analysis from around the globe, featuring the animals you love and the people who care for them. And here's your anchorman, John Rossi.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to Rossafari Zoo News, your look at everything going on in the world of zoos, aquariums, conservation, and general animal weirdness for the week. And speaking of the fact that we are all weird animals, I wanted to update y'all about my hand. So I know that last week I told y'all that I had burnt my hand, and I was told there was going to be all kinds of nasty, gross stuff happening with blisters and skin sloughing off and just all kinds of nastiness. And I was leaving for a gig and pretty freaked out, even though early indications were that it was not quite as bad as they had maybe made it out to be. Well, I got out to Salt Lake City and my hands were absolutely fine. I played the gig like the crazy over-the-top drummer I am, using both hands, and never once experienced any pain, any issues, anything. So last week, I think I said that I thought I might have gotten away with one, and I am here to officially tell you that I officially got away with one, y'all. So thanks to everyone who reached out and sent their condolences or their concerns or just have been checking up on me throughout the week asking how my hand was. But honestly, it was fine. And not only was it fine, but I have to tell y'all, my experience out west was pretty freaking great. So we flew into Salt Lake City, and then the next day went to Elko, Nevada to play our gig, and then flew home. And although I only had about half a day in Salt Lake City, I really made the most of it. I went to the Tracy Aviary, where I got to finally meet former guest Helen DeShaw, who is an incredible trainer and is such a lovely human. And we took some of her birds for walks, and it was absolutely stellar. Then after that, I ran to Hogel Zoo, where I got to see their new red panda cub, red pandlet, and just really explore a zoo that I hadn't been to before. They were two new facilities for me, and I had an amazing time at both. Then after that, I met up with my buddies Jason and Nate, and we went to the Mormon Tabernacle and saw some of that stuff, and then went to dinner at a place called Spitz with a Z. If you're ever in Salt Lake City, I highly recommend Spitz. It's a really cool place. I think there are actually a couple of them there. They do a lot of Mediterranean food and some halal, and it's just lovely. Actually, it was kind of fun. So almost 8 years ago now, when I was on my first tour of Million Dollar Quartet, we spent the night in Salt Lake City, and it was after a very long travel day, and nobody wanted to go and explore except for me and Jason. And Jason at the time was this person who I was spending a lot of time with on stage, but we had not really talked. We hadn't really built a relationship. And we explored Salt Lake City and went and did all of the Mormon stuff and got to hear the Mormon Tabernacle Choir rehearsing and watch some of that. And then we went and found this restaurant called Spitz, and we ate there. And it's really when we bonded and really when we became friends. And this is the person who is in Under the Sun with me and who I performed Great Balls of Fire with. He's the guy who wrote that show. And we've done multiple Million Dollar Quartets together. And he's just one of my favorite humans. And it was really cool to be back in Salt Lake City, back where that friendship started, and even to go back to the restaurant where we really first bonded and sit and talk all those years later, just out doing the gigging thing all that time later. The life of a professional musician is weird and cool, and I really, really enjoyed deepening our friendship even more at the place where it started. So that was a lot of fun for me. But hey, that's enough about me. Let's get on to this whole zoo news thing, shall we?
Ooh,
right. So we normally start this off with births and deaths, and we will get there. But honestly, I'd be remiss to not start with the biggest news of the week, which is that, ladies and gentlemen, the pandas have left the building. In particular, I'm talking about, and I know you all know this, but the giant pandas, or the panda bears, that lived at the Smithsonian Zoo in Washington, D.C., have now returned home to China. They were crated up Wednesday morning and left the zoo early, went to Dulles International Airport, where they flew to their new home in China on a plane that was a FedEx plane, actually. And they put little stickers of pandas on and big like decals and called it the Panda Express and flew them to China. Some of the keeper team, including one of my friends, actually got to go with the bears to help with the transition, which I think is pretty darn cool. And it was amazing watching the coverage. My parents live in the DC area, and my mom told me that they actually covered like every step of the journey on the local news. She said it reminded her of the OJ Simpson Bronco chase back in the day, which I think it was, I think that was slightly different, but literally there were aerial coverages happening on the news just nonstop as they drove to Dulles and then as they loaded onto the plane and then as the plane took off. So it's a big deal. This is the first time since the 70s that Washington, D.C. has not had giant pandas, and there's no plan to bring them back. Interestingly enough, when the zoo announced this was happening, I mean, we've known that the pandas were going to leave at the end of this agreement for quite some time, but they originally gave an early December date as the time that the pandas were going to leave. Then not terribly long ago, they announced that it was going to be a mid-November date. However, it was not until the morning of Wednesday when the pandas were leaving that the zoo announced that it was the day. People who showed up as the zoo was opening to go see the pandas instead got to watch the custom-made crates leaving the zoo. A lot of people have booked travel and were trying to get there before the announced dates of mid-November, including some close friends who are very, very hurt by this. But, you know, I have to say the zoo did say that they would be leaving by mid-November. And I think there were a lot of reasons why they couldn't give the exact date. I'm not sure if there was anything about that in the agreement with China. But also, I'm not sure if it was just that it was decided that the bears were ready and maybe they thought it would take them longer to acclimate to the crates, or if they were worried about anti-zoo organizations showing up to protest or something like that. I don't really know. But my guess is that I've seen some people saying online, like, oh, they were being deceptive. And no, the Smithsonian Zoo was not trying to trick you and make you feel bad. I can pretty much guarantee that. But it's really crazy. It's the end of an era, and it's just so strange to think about the fact that those giant pandas are not at the Smithsonian National Zoo anymore. I miss them being there, I'm not going to lie. And I'm really glad that I got to go and see them one more time 2 weeks ago. I actually heard that last weekend, the lines to see them were over 2 hours in length. And we didn't really have any lines when we went. So it all worked out pretty darn well. And honestly, I wonder how many people, if you would have gone this next weekend or whatever, which would have been the assumed last weekend, would have even enjoyed the experience. Because if there were 2+ hour lines last weekend, it was only going to be worse this weekend. But yeah, sending condolences to the team at the National Zoo. And I'm glad to see that everything went well with the transport. And yeah, just a weird time, something I never thought I would see happen. But that brings us to our births and deaths segment, and we have a bunch kind of in both categories today, so let's get to it. The Como Zoo has announced the birth of a brand new giraffelet. In case you didn't know it, one cool thing about giraffelets is that they stand within an hour of their birth. It's really cool to see how quickly they get going like that, and the little giraffe at the Como Zoo is no exception. And actually, that's not the only giraffelet we have this week, as the Los Angeles Zoo has announced the birth of a Maasai giraffe. This was another healthy giraffe that was also on its feet in no time, so congrats to the teams at the LA Zoo and the Como Zoo. SeaWorld San Diego has announced the birth of a female emperor penguin chick. Penglet? Emperor penglet. This marks the first time since 2010 that an emperor penguin chick has hatched at SeaWorld San Diego, which is especially important as SeaWorld San Diego is the only zoo in the Western Hemisphere where emperor penguins can be found. So just an incredible, incredible birth. The Metro Richmond Zoo has announced the birth of a male gemsbok, a large antelope species. I guess that would make it a gemslet, which I really like. I actually kind of love it. I also love celebrating the birth of cool lesser-known species, so this one made me very happy. Yay, gemslet. The Bronx Zoo has announced the birth of two snow leopard cubs, or snow leplets. The leplets are doing well, playing with enrichment and with each other. They are hugely important from a genetic standpoint, as they are the grandchildren of Leo, a snow leopard who was rescued as an orphaned cub in Pakistan and moved to the Bronx Zoo when he was deemed non-releasable, making his genetic representation in the AZA-SSP incredibly important. Also, not gonna lie, they're just like really cute. I've seen a bunch of different snow leplets over the years, most notably at the Akron Zoo and the Toledo Zoo, and they're always adorable. So if you have the chance to get to the Bronx Zoo, they are on exhibit and being adorable. And speaking of important births, the Houston Zoo has announced the hatching of a Malagasy sacred ibis chick, also known as a Malagasy sacred iblet. This marks the first time one of these birds has been able to successfully hatch in North America. So with the species in trouble, with an estimated population of between 2,000 and 3,000 individuals left in the wild, five AZA-accredited facilities received breeding flocks from zoos in Germany in the hopes of creating a sustainable population. However, the birds have not done a good job of incubating their eggs, so the team at the Houston Zoo decided to pull one of the eggs, the one in question, and incubate it properly. Their hope was to return it to the nest, but this became impossible when the parents abandoned said nest. So the team is now hand-rearing the chick. The goal of the team is to do so in such a way that the bird does not become habituated to humans, which is being accomplished by using a plush ibis to help parent the chick, hiding human faces when keepers interact with the bird, and generally doing everything in their power to make sure the chick is able to integrate back into the flock as soon as it is able to. This is an absolutely incredible achievement at the Houston Zoo, and hopefully lots more births follow. But of course, the flip side of births is deaths, and we have a few of those to talk about this week. Starting with Franklin Park Zoo in Massachusetts, which has announced the passing of Menelik, the 26-year-old zebra that lived in the giraffe savanna area of the zoo. He died of natural causes after living at the zoo for 24 of his 26 years, which made him the oldest living male Grevy's zebra in all of North America. He will be missed. And I have to say, if you ever go to Franklin Park Zoo, or I guess I have to say, if you ever went to Franklin Park Zoo and just saw this like gorgeous zebra out with the giraffes, it was quite a sight. I can't really explain why. Like, you see zebra and giraffe in the same exhibit a lot, but there was something about this one that just always popped whenever I was in Boston. So sorry to see him go. The Honolulu Zoo has announced the passing of Harriet, the female Linnaeus's two-toed sloth who passed away from kidney disease. Staff members say that Harriet was very lovable and a very good mother who always allowed staff to work with her and her babies super well. She was also the star of the sloth cam that the zoo had, so people all around the world loved Harriet, not just people at the Honolulu Zoo. She will truly be missed by the staff there and the people who were her fans online all around the world. The Kansas City Zoo and Aquarium has announced the passing of Nala, a lioness. At the age of 22, Nala was one of the oldest lions in the AZA, and she sadly passed away due to metastatic cancer. Now, the median life expectancy of a lion in an AZA facility is 16.9 years, which is up from anywhere to 12 to 16 years in the wild. So 22 is an incredible age for Nala to have reached and speaks very highly of, everything that the Kansas City Zoo and Aquarium did to take amazing care of this geriatric lion. And then, it's another week where we have to talk about losing a human in the zoo world. I'm sending all my love and condolences to the team at Zoo Atlanta, who announced the loss of their senior director of collections and conservation, Jennifer Mickelberg. The Georgia AAZK chapter is asking people to attend their Brazilian bingo event, which supports Save the Golden Lion Tamarin, an organization that Jennifer was on the board of directors for since 2010, and which was incredibly important to her. If you can't attend that event, the zoo is asking that you consider making a donation in Jennifer's name to Save the Golden Lion Tamarin directly at the links that I have in the show notes. Jennifer's dream was building a wildlife corridor that would connect a large amount of the separated golden lion tamarins in the wild population. And now Save the Golden Lion Tamarin is determined to make that happen in her name. So if you can give anything at all to that cause, please check the show notes and help carry on the legacy of this incredible woman. And again, sending all the love and condolences to the team at Zoo Atlanta. And from there, we move on to our other zoo news stuff. So we'll start off with the Sedgwick County Zoo, which has been doing an amazing job being transparent about how they are hand-rearing a baby chimpanzee. And it is like really, really cool to see y'all. So the chimp's name is Alizeti, which means sunflower in Swahili. She was born back in August, but her mom, Chucky, was not exhibiting proper maternal behavior, so the team decided to start her off by hand-rearing her. The zoo has been giving incredible updates, including explaining that hand-rearing a chimp requires around-the-clock care and attention. They have also carefully selected a future foster mother in the troop, Sukari. But since it will have been a few months between her birth and when she is able to be fostered, she has had to learn how to be a chimp in a variety of ways. For starters, her keepers have had to simulate appropriate chimp communication so that Alizeti can learn how to communicate properly. So they've been making the grunts and other noises that chimps make in order to teach her how to speak, so to speak. That was weird. Anyway, they have also been teaching her to cling to fur by wearing what basically looks like a big snuffle mat, if you've ever used those with dogs or anything. And they wear it as a top, and then Alizeti can cling to it, just like she eventually will to other chimps in the family, including Sukari. They've also been taking her outside to let her experience the chimpanzee habitat and teaching her how to take her bottles through mesh since her foster mom won't be able to produce milk. Now, a lot of this they do, the teaching, by showing Alizeti a stuffed baby chimp, quote, doing the thing and then having her try it. It might be the cutest thing I've ever seen from a chimp, and you can check out a lot of their pictures on social media by going to @SedgwickCountyZoo. I highly recommend that you check it out. The New England Aquarium has welcomed their first sea turtle patient of the 2023-2024 cold stun season. It's a Kemp's Ridley sea turtle that is in stable condition right now, so the season is off to a great start. I love the work that zoos and aquariums do to help save gold-stunned sea turtles, and I look forward to hearing lots of great stories from this upcoming cold-stunned season. The Australian Reptile Park has a video on its social media that is really worth checking out, if you're not afraid of spiders. So, a member of the public turned in an egg sac of funnel web spiders, and they filmed it opening and the birth of over 100 tiny spiderlings, or on this podcast, spidelets. These spiders will be joining the funnel web spider anti-venom program at the facility, which obviously helps save human lives. And this is actually part of a program that all of my new and older Aussie listeners can help with. Because if you see a funnel web spider egg sac, you can check out the website of the Australian Reptile Park to find drop-off locations to help the program. You can be the next person to take one of these funnel egg sacs and give it to Australian Reptile Park so they have more spiders for their anti-venom thing, which is very cool, although I know most of you listening to this are going, hell no, I'm not touching one of those things. And I get it. I used to be afraid to. I get it. But it's very cool to watch this video, and it's a very cool program that they are running there. So, yeah, very cool. The Seattle Aquarium has teamed up with Nintendo of America through the end of the year, doing a collaboration between the Nintendo game Animal Crossing and the aquarium. Characters from the game will be at the aquarium to help teach messages about the real-life sea otters, harbor seals, and the octopus that live at the aquarium. It is very cool to see the aquarium teaming up with Nintendo like this, and I'll be curious to see if it has any impact, especially as Animal Crossing is a wildly popular Switch game. Now, on a side note, Nintendo has announced that they are developing a live-action Legend of Zelda movie. This has nothing to do with animal stuff, but I really love the Zelda games, and so I wanted to share with you all. I'm really excited. Interesting story out of Cincinnati this week. Hamilton County, where the zoo is located, does something on voting day where they allow future voters, people under the age of 18, to cast ballots from an early age, thus encouraging them to get good voting habits going early. Of course, these aren't political ballots. They vote on things like whether they prefer pizza or ice cream, baseball or football, etc. Interestingly, one of the questions this year was whether these future voters prefer Fiona or Fritz. And Fritz actually beat out Fiona. The race was close, with Fritz getting 51.2% of the vote to Fiona's 48.8%. But I think this shows that the younger kids connect to the hippo they are growing up with more than to the famous story of Fiona, although her story is obviously the more famous one in the world around because of the details and because, you know, she was so heavily promoted on social media and regular media and all that stuff. And I'm now going to do the thing that everybody who analyzes voting results and polling does, and just way over extrapolate what I should be able to from there, which, you know, it makes me question what'll happen down the road, though, because many Fiona fans that I know have wondered for quite some time what will happen when it's breeding time for the siblings. And I think they've been pretty secure in the knowledge that Cincinnati would never move Fiona because of her popularity in the city. However, if younger citizens feel more connected to Fritz, is there a chance that will change? Again, I'm reading way too much into what is basically a fake election involving kids, but it does actually bring up the question of, you know, if Fritz became the more popular hippo, would the zoo take that into consideration? Would the SSP take that into consideration? What would happen? It's hard to say, but for now, let's just be happy that the most amazing bloat anywhere happens to be at the Cincinnati Zoo. Although I really love Jenny and Button at Adventure Aquarium because they're my friends. Anyway, moving on. Actually, not moving on, because we're going to stick in Cincy for this next story, but moving on from hippos. The zoo recently announced that their Asian elephant herd has grown by 4 members. The 4 elephants are 2 adult females and their young male calves, and they come from the Dublin Zoo on a joint breeding recommendation between the AZA and the EAZA, the European Association of Zoos and Aquaria. They are settling in nicely into Elephant Trek, the new, largest habitat the zoo has ever built. And on a fun side note, we all know the AZA breeding recs go through SSPs, or Species Survival Plans. Well, EASA has the same basic idea, but they are called EEPs, for Endangered Ex Situ Programs. I actually like that more, not because of the actual name, but because I really like just saying EEP. And I realize they don't do that. This is just a me thing. But like, I would just call them EEPs. I would be like, hey, did you guys see that you're getting a new red panda at your zoo because of a breeding rec through the EEP? It's just fun to say EEP. Anyway, speaking of elephants, the Hogle Zoo recently decided to move their 2 remaining elephants to a new facility where they would have more room, a larger herd, and a male for potential breeding. The Kansas City Zoo and Aquarium has now taken the 2 elephants into their herd, which is already 7 elephants strong. When I was at Hogle this past week, I saw that they invested a lot of time and money into putting up signage explaining the move. And honestly, in looking at the elephant habitat there, I think it was the right choice. I'm sure they did great work with their elephants there, not at all putting it down, but I was very proud of the zoo for making this choice, for being transparent about it, and for taking the time to really explain the decision to their guests. It was really beautiful to see, honestly. On a side note, these last 2 stories are just the latest evidence of something that I keep saying, which is that I believe that while the AZA keeps affirming its commitment to elephants living in zoos, we are going to see fewer zoos with elephants and larger herds and exhibits at the zoos that do still have them, which I think is, you know, probably a good direction for that to be going in. Oh, and while on the theme of elephants in zoos, the Honolulu Zoo is the latest zoo to become victim to the annoying habit of suing for elephants to be removed from zoos that keeps being done unsuccessfully by the, quote, animal rights, end quote, group known as the Non-Human Rights Project. Now, we've talked about this on here before. The NRP sues zoos with elephants, knowing they won't be able to win freedom for the elephants, but trying to punish the zoos by making them spend lots of money in litigation and also, you know, giving said zoos some bad press. In this case, the group is saying they want what is best for the elephants, which is total bull crap. Get it? Bull? Like a bull elephant? But seriously, it's crap. As a matter of fact, the group even drops the red herring all of these fake groups drop, saying there is a chance that if the elephants got to a sanctuary, they would then be eligible for release back into the wild. It is the ultimate fake hope, encouraging people who envision the wild as some pristine environment where animals live unharmed and would manage to function after living in zoos for most of their lives. And as any listener of this podcast knows, it is utterly fake. When zoos actually do raise animals to be released into the wild, something I'll point out that the Non-Human Rights Project does not do, because they absolutely love making a stink and making money and nothing more than that, in my humble opinion, they handle them very differently than they handle their normal animals. These elephants at the Honolulu Zoo cannot be released into the wild. Period. But the NRP will tell people they, quote, might be, because then, to their followers, they seem like they are potential heroes, which means they'll get more money donated to them. Y'all, this is Toki all over again without the water. It's honestly pathetic to see, and it will fail, just as this group constantly fails, all while growing their presence and lining their pockets. Maybe the non-humans they mention in their name are the people in leadership positions in the group. Just a thought. And just again, because I know these groups can be wildly litigious, I would just like to point out that this is all my opinion and I'm, you know, not stating facts except for the obvious ones like, hey, they've tried this before and it hasn't worked. But in my opinion, these people suck. Opinionly, obviously. All right, but let's end our apparent elephant segment that we got into this week with a less bad and, frankly, more Rossifari-esque story. Though perhaps one that isn't made for the younger or fainter of heart amongst us. So if you're in one of those crowds, please skip ahead about a minute. Miles, I'm talking to you. Skip this story. Or don't. You're very mature. Whatever. Anyway, the Denver Zoo has become known as specialists in the acquisition and study of elephant semen. Their elephant herd is entirely male, which is really rare in the country. Four of the six members of the herd are trained for semen collection, with a fifth currently in training. Given the logistical issues of moving elephants around the country, and given that females tend to kick males out of herds when not actively breeding, the collection of semen allows for sperm to be sent instead of the bull elephant. In case you were wondering, it takes four people to get a sperm sample from an elephant. One to feed it the entire time, one to collect the ejaculate, and two, to put their arms in the elephant's rectum and massage the prostate until the ejaculation occurs. And that's not all the effort that goes into the process. It turns out that elephant sperm, unlike human sperm, doesn't freeze well, so the team has had to develop a method for keeping the sperm alive while being transported. As such, the semen is sent with 36 days worth of nutrition that keeps the sperm alive as it is sent by FedEx or other couriers to the zoos where they are hoping to use it to impregnate female elephants. And while actual breeding in Asian elephants has a fairly decent success rate, the same cannot be said for the insemination efforts from this sperm so far. In fact, only one baby has been born from the process, so far. Still, the team keeps working at it, tugging away at the problem, doing research, refining their procedures, and hopefully getting closer to making the procedure more successful. It'll definitely be a load off their minds when the procedure starts working better. I know I, for one, will be jazzed. But yeah, it's really cool that the Denver Zoo is doing this, and hopefully this becomes more successful because, you know, transporting elephants is really, really tricky, especially if you were trying to transport them from somewhere like Honolulu into the wild. Ugh, there are certain groups that I just hate. Okay, but on a happier note and moving away from elephants, and hey, children and such, you can listen again. Our friends at Elmwood Park Zoo have announced the launch of a new program called the Four Program. This offers $4 admission to the zoo to community residents receiving government assistance. Making conservation learning more accessible is always a great idea, so I love this program a lot. Nice work to Elmwood Park Zoo. And to Pico for sponsoring the program. And then last but not least in Zoo News this week, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has teamed up with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the U.S. Geological Survey, the California Condor Recovery Program, the Los Angeles Zoo, the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance, the Carolina Raptor Center, and the Oregon Zoo to create and test vaccines against highly pathogenic avian influenza, a disease that is ravaging birds in the wild, causing zoos to pull their birds off exhibit, and also occasionally reaching into other species to wreak havoc. Y'all have heard me talk about bird flu or avian influenza on this podcast a lot, including two stories last week. So early testing of the vaccine looks promising. 60% of vaccinated condors developed antibodies in testing, making them the first condors to have any natural protection against the disease. Now, while 60% might be a lower number than we would hope for, the truth is it's way better than nothing, and the vaccine is still in the early phases of creation and testing. With the deaths of condors from avian influenza this year alone considered enough to set the recovery of the species back by a decade, every single life helped by a vaccine is a huge victory for this imperiled species. Also, there is hope that the vaccine will be able to be adapted to other birds, as avian influenza really is wreaking havoc on many species of birds, not just condors. So, in general, this is really good news, and hopefully the start of the end of the avian influenza story. I know that seems like a long stretch, but hey, we can hope.
Stereotypical Animal Podcast theme song. Here to bring you to conservation news.
All right, this is a story that I keep saying time and again, but it makes me happy, so I'll keep repeating all the various forms of it because it's good news. The Outer Banks in North Carolina has announced a record year in sea turtle nests in the area. This joins places I've already reported on, like areas of South Florida and in Texas, which have also reported the highest nesting they have seen in history. Yay, sea turtles. Oh, and actually, since I found and started talking about this story about North Carolina, the Disney Conservation Team Wildlife has also announced their nesting results in their area of Florida, and they found almost double the amount of sea turtle nests that they usually find in a season. It has been an amazing year for sea turtle nests all around their nesting grounds, which is a testament to the amazing conservation work being done to save these incredible animals. When you are in Florida, when you are on the beaches of Florida and you see everyone just leaving the nests alone, and most of the houses having no lights on or red lights and just respecting all those rules, it's really astonishing to see. I feel like in the times that we live in now, watching a group of people who may not be politically aligned, who may not be besties, who may not care about a lot of things, take those steps for sea turtles is incredible. And yeah, a lot of it is legal. They have to do it, but that doesn't mean they're going to do it or they want to do it. And I don't know, it just doesn't seem to be a big negative thing. I'm constantly amazed at the conservation work done in Florida in specific, despite the fact that based on the way the population votes down there, you would not always expect them to focus so much on that. I know we've talked about that with Path of the Panther and with some other stories on Zoo News, and this is just the latest example of people crossing political lines, people banding together, and people actually working to save an endangered species, and it warms my heart. All right, so I debated whether to throw this next story into other news or here, but I'm going to throw it into conservation news because, you know, human-animal conflict, even the ones that we get to kind of have fun with, is a huge, huge problem that conservationists need to figure out and work around and solve. So a new scientific theory as to why certain pods of orcas are sinking boats has emerged after another boat was recently sunk by orcas. And I think the theory is kind of fascinating. Again, just a theory. And we're not talking about, like, you know, theory of relativity, which is pretty well accepted. This is just a hypothesis at this point, right? But it seems that most of the boats are destroyed when orcas go after the rudder of the boat specifically. They tend to nudge it with their bodies until it snaps, making a loud popping noise in the process. And now some scientists believe that orcas are pursuing this pop for fun, kind of like a kid popping bubble wrap. I don't know why I said a kid. I love popping bubble wrap, but I'm basically a kid. Anyway, many experts agree that orcas aren't actually trying to sink boats, as they could do so easily and in a variety of ways, instead of just, you know, going after the rudder. But yeah, this is the best the scientists currently have. So I like it. I like the idea. I like that they're having fun and making cool noises. And, you know, that's all it is. It's kind of fascinating. President Joe Biden spoke to Congress about the need to combat the illegal wildlife trade this week. In his remarks, President Biden focused on the need to help save the pangolin, the most widely trafficked animal on the planet. He said the United States will take the steps necessary to end the illegal wildlife trade for pangolins in order to save the species from extinction, with the goal of demonstrating progress by the end of the year. Keep in mind, it is already November 10th, so that's pretty cool. Now, while I'm as cynical as anyone when it comes to the American government getting, you know, anything done, it's cool to see that this speech happened, and we may as well hope it pays off in some measurable way. Let's save those pangolins. Let's start by the end of the year. I'm all about it. And then last but not least in conservation news this week, there's a species of spider that you might start seeing if you live in the United States. This is the latest species of spider that was discovered in the U.S., and it's known as a Joro spider. It's a large, brightly covered spider species that travels in a method known as ballooning, which is when they use their web silks to carry them on the wind to new locations. Joro spiders are a type of golden orb weaver, and they are venomous, but their fangs don't penetrate human skin, and they only try to bite as an absolute last resort when threatened. Now, the spider arrived in the U.S. from East Asian countries back in like 2013 or so, and it has been very slowly expanding its range. Joro spiders can now be found in Georgia, the Carolinas, and Tennessee, but it is expected that they will use ballooning soon to continue to expand until they inhabit most of the eastern United States. A new, beautiful, and relatively not dangerous spider that can kind of fly? Sign me up. But I know a lot of you will be worried about this, so just a reminder that this is a spider that will be beautiful, will make incredibly gorgeous webs, won't hurt you, won't hurt your pets, and will help take down annoying insect populations. So as the Joro spider population in the U.S. continues to grow, and since there seems to be no ecological damage being done in the areas that it's already in, because it is an invasive species, and you do have to consider that, until we're told otherwise, let's welcome the Joro spider to our, you know, parts of the country that it's not in yet. Let's be friends with the Joro spider, right? Y'all gonna be friends? Cool.
In other news.
So, one of the more interesting things about evolution is that it's obviously fake. I kid. But it is an always changing and ongoing process, which I feel is something that a lot of people tend to forget. We tend to use terminology like animals evolved to this point, which is true, but species are still actively evolving all the time. And now it seems like skunks may be evolving in a surprising way. So for a long time, most striped skunks had a fairly consistent white racing stripe style pattern on their otherwise black bodies. However, scientists have noticed that these patterns are changing, which is pretty surprising. So generally, when a species has a consistent signal of danger, it makes it easier for predators to learn to stay away from that pattern and thus stay away from all the individuals of the species that have that pattern. So it has always made sense, evolutionarily, for skunks to have similar patterns from skunk to skunk. But now, skunks are exhibiting all kinds of patterns, from just a small patch of white on their heads, to multiple stripes, to cape-like patterns, to literally all black or all white animals. Research across different locations shows that in areas with high skunk predation, the stripes are staying relatively consistent, but in areas where predation is down, the skunks are evolving different patterns. it seems likely that this is less a change brought on by natural selection, and more that natural selection is less important in those areas, so to speak. In other words, in areas where predation is high, more of the genes of animals that don't have the standard racing stripe would disappear into the gullets of predators, but in areas where those skunks are less likely to get eaten, their genes have a better chance of passing on from generation to generation. Now, while it's an interesting story, it also may well be an indication from nature that humans are wiping out too many predators, something we've talked about on here a lot. So while it's nice to think that skunks can look pretty and different because they don't have a lot of predators, that might not always be the best thing. Predators are actually important to ecological balance. So definitely something to keep an eye on. But I have to say, it is really cute seeing these different patterns on skunks. And while the skunk color change is happening on a species-wide basis, at least in certain areas, we are starting to see additional interesting colorations in other animals. So we all know about the two giraffe, one born at a zoo and one born in the wild, who were born without spots, or possibly with one big spot covering their entire body, depending on how you look at it. Well, now, a new pattern has been seen on a zebra living in Africa. The zebra, named Tira, was born with melanism, making the coat appear a deep brown color, with most of the body covered in white spots, which turn into stripes only on the rump and legs of the zebra. Fascinating stuff, and I really like the word rump. But yeah, it's really interesting to see a kind of brown polka-dotted horse and be like, oh yeah, zebra. And then last but not least, in other news this week, a photographer named Dmitry Koch traveled to Koliuchin Island, a place where humans used to live and their buildings remain. Now, only polar bears inhabit the area, including spending time in the dilapidated buildings, which is what Dmitry was able to document with some incredible photographs. Literally, some of the polar bears were looking out the windows of the various buildings as the photographer walked by, just as like a human neighbor would. There's one polar bear who is literally just like laying in a doorway. It's really adorable, and the images are really fascinating. So if you haven't seen them yet, make sure you Google the polar bears that are living in abandoned buildings and check them out, because it's pretty darn cool.
Animal, animal, animal holidays. Animal, animal, animal holidays.
All right, and then November is Manatee Awareness Month. Polar Bear Week runs through Saturday the 11th, and then from November 12th through the 18th, it is Orangutan Caring Week. For your individual holidays this week, Friday the 10th is Science Day for Peace and Development. Cool name. The 14th is the International Day of Zoo and Aquarium Educators. Though I've actually seen a lot of facilities celebrating that day on different dates this past week, but the 14th is the official day of that. So, and then the 15th is Steve Irwin Day, America Recycles Day, and Orange is for Orangutan Day. And those are your animal holidays for the week. All right, so there you have it. Rossafari Zoo News is done for the first time in my entire life without panda bears being in Washington, D.C. Still can't quite get over that. But hey, I'd like to remind you all to make sure that you hit subscribe so you don't miss any Zoo News episodes or interview episodes. Make sure you're following along at Rossafari on socials, at Rossafari Pod on TikTok. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so for as little as $3 a month by going to patreon.com/Rossafari. I'd especially like to say thank you to my Red Panda level patrons, Dr. Laura Shank, Dr. Stephen Williamson, and Barbara Bennett. And I'd also like to say thank you to everyone who contributed stories to this week's episode. Don't forget, you can tag me in stories or send them to me, rossafaripod@gmail.com. And whether I use them or not, I'll say your name at the end of the episode. So thank you to my contributors this week. Anya Keen, Colleen Lenahan, Kim Cooley Croninger. Yeah, you got married, Kim. Woo! Carrie Kirkpatrick, Kevin Williams, Nat Berry, Liz Dunleavy, Daisy Barrett, Dr. Laura Shank, Jay Meredith, Sam Evans, Lisa Clare, Dr. Zoe Rossi, Emily Rockbuck, Ali Malensky, Kay Malensky, the Malenskys, Sabo, Amanda Berg, and Becca Robinson. Thank you all so much for contributing. And remember, friends, the words Newsy credits backwards are Steiderk, you swen.
The Rossafari Podcast is produced, hosted, and engineered by John Rossi. Editing and fact-checking by John and Dr. Zoe Rossi. Our theme song is Sevens by Nathan Burke, performed by Nathan and John. Interrupting John theme and additional voices by Taylor Isaac Gray. You can reach John directly on Instagram and Facebook at Rossafari or by email at rossafaripod@gmail.com. Rossafari is part of the Daydreamer Media Network. Now, stop listening to me and go visit a zoo.
Tend to have skunks where the stripes are staling, Jeez, oh, Pete.